This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. In 2011, Lex Gillette set a world record for totally blind athletes in the long jump. It wasn't long before he broke his own record by leaping 22 feet 2 inches. Lex first represented Team USA at the Athens Paralympics in 2004 and has medaled at every Paralympic Games since. And yet the gold medal has eluded the world record holder. Now with the 2020 Paralympics delayed, Lex is itching for his shot to bring home the gold. Lex grew up in Raleigh, went to Athens Drive Magnet High School before heading to East Carolina University, and joins me now on the State of Things. Lex Gillette, welcome.
Hey, how are you, Frank?
I'm doing well. It's good to talk with you. And I'd like you to take us back to the beginning when your athletic history. Were you always planning and running and jumping around as a child?
Yeah, growing up, I definitely was an athletic kid. Even before I lost my sight, I played recreation baseball. I didn't swim competitively, but I would, you know, run, jump in the pool. I knew how to swim. And after I had lost my sight, of course, I had to transition from being able to see to not being able to see. But eventually, I got into adapted sports and recreation. So I found out about goal ball, which is a sport specifically for blind and visually impaired participants. I also learned about beat baseball, which is an accessible form of baseball for the blind and visually impaired. I wrestled in high school, and eventually I found track and field. So I think once that I successfully transitioned to this world of not having eyesight, it really helped me to increase my comfortability and confidence in a lot of ways, to the point where once I found sports and rec, I was able to jump into that. No pun intended.
Well, I want to hear a little bit, too, about that home in Raleigh and the part it played. One feature in particular in that childhood home, that particular ledge that played a part in your athletic history. Tell us that story.
Yeah. So there was this 3-foot-high ledge in front of our door. And kind of painting the scene here, this ledge below, there was pretty large patch of grass. So you could run, leap off of this ledge, land into the grass, you can do flips and roll around and things like that. Before I had lost my sight, I used to run and jump off of that ledge all of the time, spread my arms like wings and pretend like I was flying. And that feeling of being suspended in the air for a moment in time was, you know, it's something that it's addictive. I just love that feeling. And once I had lost my sight, I don't know how long it was that I stayed away from that ledge, naturally just trying to get through living life without being able to see. But once I had, you know, gotten to that point where I mustered up the courage to get back out there and jump off of that ledge, I was able to recreate that feeling again, and experience that ledge in a different way. So when I think about it now, I think that when I had lost my sight, now I was thrust into this world that they don't really understand the plight from my perspective. They don't necessarily understand the experiences and how I live. And so a lot of times those things show up in expectations as to what people think you should and should not do, or what you can and cannot do as a person with a disability. And symbolically speaking, that's like gravitational pull. It's like it's locking you to the earth. And I didn't see myself as someone who should be confined to what others' expectations are. So running and jumping off of that ledge was my ability to kind of defy gravity and defy what people expected me to do and what they thought I should be trying to, you know, conquer in the world. So I actually went back to that ledge, I want to say maybe 4 or 5 years ago. And to be back in that environment, I could have almost cried because I hadn't been there for probably 20 years. So to go back there and to reminisce and to think about what that ledge did for me, literally and figuratively,
right.
I mean, in a lot of ways, it helped to propel me to this point in life, athletically and off of the track.
How old were you when you started losing your sight?
I was 8 years old, and literally just a random type of occurrence. Go home, going through your day-to-day routine. That night when I was actually getting ready for bed, when I started noticing that my sight was blurred and things were looking faint, looking different. My mom and I, we had thought that maybe I had just gotten something in my eyes from earlier in the day. So we did what we can do to try to clean my eyes out. Didn't help. Next thought was to go to sleep. Maybe everything would be okay in the morning. Nothing had changed. So we eventually went to the doctor, and after an examination, they said that I needed to have an emergency operation to repair retina detachments. And that led to a string of 10 operations that I had that year. The pattern was go in, have an operation, stabilize the sight that I did have for about 3 to 4 weeks. And after that time, my sight would get blurry again, most times more than what it was the time before, which would lead to another operation to repair retina detachments. They would stabilize that sight. I would be able to see for another 3 to 4 weeks. After that time, sight would get blurry again, have to go back to the doctor and have another operation. So it was in and out of the hospital for the entire time.
Meanwhile, your hopes rising and falling that whole time. I can just imagine how each time you think maybe this one's gonna keep, and then it doesn't.
Yeah. I mean, you go into the first couple ones, you're optimistic, but as you continue to have them, I think by the time I got to the 8th, 9th, and 10th one, I think subconsciously you think within yourself, okay, this might be the reality that I'll have to face for the rest of life.
And your mom was visually impaired. How did this, your change in eyesight, affect your relationship with your mom?
I think in a lot of ways it strengthened that bond and strengthened our relationship. I never really saw my mom as someone who's visually impaired. I always saw her, she's a no excuses type person, always challenging me to put my best foot forward and to do my absolute best. And to see her, you know, holding down a job and making sure I had everything that I needed, I just didn't see her as, you know, anything other than, okay, this is my mom, and she's doing everything that she can to make sure I have the resources that I need. So it served as a really good example for me growing up to know that, okay, this is how it should be done, and this is what I need to do, and this is the mindset I need to have in order to go out here and succeed.
You and your mom made the decision to stay in public schools. You could have joined some specialized or participated in specialized programs, decided to stay in public school. A big choice, obviously, that a lot of families have to struggle with. How did you feel about that at the time?
I didn't know any different. I think, I was used to being around, you know, interacting and participating alongside my sighted peers. A lot of my friends in the neighborhood where I grew up, they could see and they accepted me. I think the biggest thing was going to schools, public schools, where now you're being introduced to new students and new kids who may not understand what I can see, what I can't see, and just trying to fight through that, those initial insecurities. And
well, because if I've got it right, you were one of only 10 visually impaired kids at the school. So yeah, there would not have been a lot of familiarity among teachers, staff, or the other students. And I just wonder how you did navigate that and what kind of challenges that presented for you.
I mean, I had a visually impaired teacher who ensured that I was able to, you know, have all of the resources that I needed to, you know, successfully do what I need to do in the classroom. Outside of that, from a social standpoint, it was literally just me having the courage to make friends, to be vulnerable, to let them know what I needed and what I didn't need. I never really dealt with bullying or anything like that. I like to have fun as well. So yeah, I joke around and things like that. So I think that in a lot of ways that made other students feel comfortable as well and made them feel as though they didn't have to, you know, act like super different.
But you didn't have a lot of experience. I just wonder how this played out for you, because you, as you said, you were 8 years old when you started to lose your eyesight. So in other words, you lost that 8 years of experience navigating that world with other folks. And I'm wondering if that makes things more difficult, or maybe it makes it easier, I don't know, to integrate with kids, you know, because you don't have the experience of kind of dealing with that world. On the other hand, maybe you don't have the inhibitions that may have built in over those 8 years. I don't know how that would play out, and I don't even know how you could answer that, but I wonder if you've thought about it.
Yeah, no, I think like when it first happened, of course, it was definitely challenging, and I dealt with the insecurities and holding your head down and wondering if people would look at you differently and wondering if people would accept you and understand you. But I think that I had a lot of different individuals in my life who really just challenged me, and they wouldn't allow me to wallow in that grief. Of course, I had time to transition and to literally grieve over not being able to see anymore. But at a certain point in time, you just have to get to that space where, okay, well, this is the reality. This is what it is. So we have to figure out what the next steps are. And although I have my mom, and she serves as a really strong influence for me, there were a number of things that she did as well, reaching out to other individuals who could help me in finding different resources and programs and tools and technology, and making sure that I had a 360 degree perspective and view of what these next steps would look like. And eventually I aligned with those things and was able to kind of push the envelope and keep navigating.
Well, one of the other people who helped you along the way was Brian Whitmer, and that was when you went to Athens Drive High School in Southwest Raleigh, met Brian Whitmer, and began your high school track and field career. Tell us about that.
Yes, we had a physical fitness test in my freshman year that we had to participate in, and one of the activities that we participated in was standing long jump. So stand in one spot and you jump as far as you can. And I was naturally good at jumping. Mr. Whitmer then took me to the track one day, and he showed me everything about the event, showed me the long jump runway, the takeoff board, the sand pit. And I always consider it a blessing that I was able to see at some point, because when I interact and start to really understand certain environments, it puts me in the space where I literally feel like I can see what's going on, and it helps to increase that confidence. So I knew what the event looked like in the area, but now we had to figure out, well, how is this going to happen? How are we going to successfully get me from point A to point B, the starting mark to the sand pit? And so Mr. Whitmer would stand at the takeoff point where I needed to jump from. He would clap and he would yell. So that would give me an idea of which direction he was, where he was standing and which direction I needed to run. And from there, it was me remembering how many steps I would take. And at the precise moment, I would jump and pray to God I'll land.
Well, I got to ask you two things about precision. First of all, staying on a precise line, I'm sure that's important. It's one thing to know which direction, but you also want to not wander too much from the center. How do you stay in the center? And then how do you know that precise moment? Because he's clapping and making sound the whole time, right?
Yeah. I think it's training your mind and be able to, there's so many different factors that are involved. So staying in a straight line is me literally listening to where he is and making sure that an equal type of distribution from left to right, he's in the middle of of where I'm listening.
Yeah.
And from there, whether you are sighted or not, all long jumpers, triple jumpers, high jumpers, they know how many steps it takes for them to cover their runway approach. So in that regards, I just had to, you know, follow suit in terms of what the event requires.
How about the rest of your teammates? How'd they feel about you being on the team?
I think there was a certain level of inspiration that it provided, of course. I know they definitely, they just looked at me as the next teammate, which was really cool. I think that camaraderie and being amongst other students who were competitive as well and had that competitive mindset, that was huge. And then once I actually made the shift to, now I was one of the better jumpers on our team, you know, the perspective totally changes, because now it's like, okay, we don't look at him as a blind athlete. We just look at him as like a really good athlete who just so happens to be blind.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the big moment when you actually have to perform and win the darn thing. Right. Period. Well, you end up at ECU after high school and continue to compete in track and field. How did you do there?
ECU was, it was a great time. I think although it was a great time, the challenge was that when I had got to ECU, I didn't have the same type of, I didn't have Mr. Whitmer there.
Mm-hmm.
And in high school, I was able to work out with him Monday through Friday. We worked out on the track, we lifted weights. And once I got to ECU, I had to, you know, find some sort of resource or someone who could give me that same type of support. And it took a bit for me to find someone, but one of my really good friends who was in the recreation and leisure studies program had knew someone in the exercise sports science program, and we were connected, and this person helped me to develop a training regimen and to be able to stay in some sort of shape, mm-hmm. so that I would still be able to qualify for teams. So Stacy was her name. She helped me out tremendously, and I was still able to compete at world championships and a lot of the major international competitions.
So here's you now improvising and kind of making your way through after having a little jolt of confidence in high school. And I have to ask you this, because I know now that in addition to your life as an athlete, you're also a motivational speaker, and you were showing signs of persuasiveness even then in college. When, is this true, you talked your friend into driving your girlfriend's car? His girlfriend's car? Is that right?
Yes, yes.
Well, tell me that story.
Yeah, there was one evening I come back to our apartment and ask my buddy if I can drive his car. And so he's like, nah, I don't think this is going to happen. And I said, oh man, come on, we can make it happen. Similar to long jump, if you just talk to me and let me know which direction to turn the steering wheel, then we'll be totally fine. And so finally he's like, all right, let's go. So we walk out of the apartment and we bypass his car and we hop into his girlfriend's car.
That's
he what says, oh, you thought we were gonna use mine? Absolutely not, we're gonna use hers. And so we find this empty parking lot. I get into the driver's seat, he gets into the passenger side, we buckle up. And from there it was us doing a lot of big loops in the parking lot, and him letting me know when to turn the steering wheel to the left or to the right, and definitely an invigorating experience, to say the least.
And you're here to tell us all about it and much, much more. Raleigh's own Lex Gillette is with me, world record holder in the long jump for totally blind athletes, also a musician. Our conversation continues on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned.
I see the road, Mercedes Drive. I see my plane, now I'm gonna fly. I see the stars, grab with both hands, and I'ma hold it high to brighten where you glance. I run the trail through storm and hail. They wanna break me, I'm tough as nails. I am a reason. to pain. All of this derails our train. Anytime the obstacle rises high, just face it and elevate up to the sky. Close your eyes and vision, and everything you wish will come. If you want to see for yourself, look inside your mind. That's where the luxury lies. Yeah, oh, yeah. If you want to see for yourself, look inside your mind, and you will be able to stand the test of time. The test of time.
This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Lex Gillette is the world record holder in the long jump for totally blind athletes. And with the 2020 Tokyo Games on hold, Lex is training harder than ever to bring home gold for Team USA. He's from Raleigh, proud alum of North Carolina's public schools, including ECU, where he graduated in 2007, also a budding musician. Just before the break, we played a track from a little clip from Lex performing Test of Time, one of his own songs. We'll talk more about your music career, but I want to stick with sports right now because you're a four-time Paralympian. You've medaled every time you competed. What were you feeling this year when the games were delayed, if they were called off, I guess?
It was tough, I would say. That's probably an understatement. I think that when you're out there training and you're super focused and determined to get to the games and to be able to compete, I was scheduled to compete on the first day of track and field competition during the evening session. So as you can imagine, there would be a lot of people in the stadium, bright lights, and having that opportunity to compete, that's what you do it for. And then you get the news that you're not going to be able to compete. That was tough, but fortunately it's a postponement and not a cancellation, so I'm just hoping for the best right now and hoping that we'll have that opportunity next year, which the games have been rescheduled a year later. And you know, just focusing on doing what I can do, control what I can control, to make sure that when that opportunity does present itself again next year, I'll be able to do what I need to do.
Well, you talked about the fact that you love the crowd, and I've heard you say you love the fact that all those folks are watching you. Talk about this sensation that you have going into a crowded arena. I mean, how does that feel, and how do you sense the how aware are you of the number of people or their anticipation? Tell us how that feels.
I think it's just when you have everyone there, it reminds you of, I mean, you've been training for 4 years, Monday through Friday, sometimes 4 hours a day, and you train to have that opportunity to be inside of that stadium where everyone is there to see high-level competition. They want to see great performances and inspirational performances. So to know that I play a small part in that, it feels good. Definitely feels good.
And talk about the at the Paralympics too, you talked about the cooperation and the teamwork involved in helping you, sort of guiding you to the jump point, keeping you on the beam. You rely entirely on a sound guide, right, for that straight line and the signal to jump. So what about the crowd? I mean, how do you hear?
Yeah, so you have your guide who, I mean, imagine you're inside of this huge stadium, probably seats around 80, 85,000 people, depending on, you know, what stadium that you're in. I know in London, I think it was about 80, 85,000. In Beijing, I want to say it was upwards around 90,000. So for blind and visually impaired athletes who compete in the long jump, you have your guide who is standing at the takeoff board, and they're yelling and giving you that auditory signal so that you can navigate successfully down the runway. And the cooperation that needs to happen with the crowd is that you need a certain level of silence so that you can hear your guide. Because as you can imagine, if if they're yelling and screaming, then it ruins your ability to hear your guide and know which direction to run. So that's one thing that it was definitely a challenge in Rio, because we had a lot of crowd noise. But most cases, you can ask the official to send a signal up to the PA announcer, and they'll get on the loudspeaker and ask for silence, or they may put something up on the Jumbotron for everybody to see, and the crowd will then go silent so that the athletes can hear their guide and get a successful jump off.
And that had a real effect on you in Rio, right?
Yeah, it was definitely tough. I had one attempt where I felt like I could hear really good, but outside of that, there was a lot of crowd noise. There was a lot of start and stop in terms of athletes trying to get from their start mark down the runway. And the challenge is, we have 60 seconds to successfully get our attempt in. So if you don't get it in within that time frame, then you get a fault. And some of the athletes were getting disqualified or getting fouled jumps, and some of the guides of the athletes were trying to get the crowd to be quiet. And at some points, like, the crowd was booing, and it was just, yeah. It was an experience that I just would have never imagined that. But I think at the end of the day, it was 2016. I've been able to, stay healthy, to compete at a high level since then. So we'll just try to rewrite that story in 2021.
Let's talk a little bit more about some of the other differences between the Olympics and the Paralympics in terms of their support. What kind of support or level of support do you get, Team USA Paralympic team?
We get, of course, the USOPC supports us a lot. I think where some of the support could be increased is within sponsors and support for Paralympic athletes. I think when we think about equality and equitable treatment, even though there may be equality in terms of everyone having the same resources, since we are Paralympic athletes and persons with a disability, I think there could definitely be some improvement in terms of the types of support that we get based on our needs. So, for me, since I don't drive, so, maybe there could be additional support from, transportation standpoint, whereas my sighted competitors, they just hop in their car and they can drive to a competition. You look at an athlete who may utilize a prosthetic limb, and they have to pay for those types of things. So there could definitely be a lot more support that could be given to the Paralympic athletes to help from an equitable standpoint, to ensure that we are able to go in and compete at the highest of levels.
What about sponsorships? How does that work for you? Are you sort of in a channel where you can have pretty good access to sponsorship for the kinds of products or whatever? Yeah, I suppose the products that a sponsor might be interested in.
Yeah, that's always the challenge at the end of the day is getting that support, and finding companies who are number one interested, and it makes sense. It's a good fit for them. I think from the Olympic side, when you have big names like a Simone Biles or a Serena Williams or athletes of that capacity, their name speaks for themselves, and people are chomping at the bit to be partnered with them, whereas not too many people may have heard of Alex Gillette. And so we're out there kind of scratching and clawing for opportunities to have those sponsors so that we can travel, so that we can make sure that we have the best recovery options, to make sure that we can pay for registration fees and lodging fees. And of course, with the pandemic going on, having to operate differently in terms of training and most likely travel once that comes into play, it'll just be another thing that's thrown into the fold. But that piece of it is just as important as the training.
I wonder too, I mean, this takes us a little off of your story and looks at the bigger picture of international Olympics and international athletic competition. But when you think about sort of equality and all things being equal, you know, given the disparities in sort of how one nation might fund its team and, you know, what each athlete on that team is looking at compared to the American team and, I don't know, the Serbian team, probably very different kinds of treatment. So, I mean, are we always looking at the best athletes in the world? Or that's got to make a difference, right? How they're funded and, you know, sort of where they come from does make a difference, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's definitely an interesting thought. You think about the United States and the Chinas of the world and the Englands and a lot of the other larger nations who have the resources to be able to support the athletes and get the best athletes to the game. Whereas when you think about athletes from a smaller nation, they come from a different background, different experiences, and they may not have the same resources based on what they need. And I think, again, that kind of speaks to equality versus equity, because we can all have the same track, we can all have the same training facilities, et cetera, et cetera. However, the experience for an American athlete is different from, you know, a small country in Europe or Africa or wherever.
Well, you know, you've probably had time to think, too, about accessibility and to make the games more accessible, both for athletes, the Paralympic Games, and also for, you know, how to make the Paralympic Games more accessible to the rest of us as well. As you say, sponsorship is somewhat limited because of the profile. It has a somewhat lower profile. Talk about accessibility, both from the point of view of the audience and for the athletes, and what you think could be done to make it better.
Yeah, I think a lot of it is when I competed in London in 2012, that was by far one of the best experiences I've had, because the view of Paralympics and athletes with a disability is just totally different there. They essentially they're just athletes. With a disability doesn't even really seem to factor into how they view us, to the point where I was competing and I want to say I was walking through the mall and people are stopping me to ask for autographs. And, oh, we saw you on TV. Oh, that was so amazing. And then you come back home to America and it's like nothing, basically. So I think a lot of it is just really getting the American public to see that at the end of the day, these are athletes out here who are putting down amazing performances. These are athletes who are training just as hard, sweating just as much, putting in just as much work as the next athlete to be the best at their craft. And, you know, we deserve a lot of the, that same support. And it goes much more than just inspiring. I think that a lot of, you know, you'll see us compete and say, oh man, that's pretty amazing. That's incredible. But at the same time, I think that, you know, if you see the work that is done on a daily basis to get to that point, you really are like, oh, wow, this is in essence like a job,
right,
if you
right.
will. So
without the disclaimer and without the qualifier, you know, flat out, that's a lot of work. And not only are you an athlete, you're a budding musician as well. Got an EP coming out soon. Is that right?
The goal is to get it out in 2021. So we are definitely going to, like, I made it my mission to kind of make that happen. So it should be exciting. I'll sing in presentations and speeches and been to the studio many a times. But to actually put together a project, that'll be another thing that I can mark off on my to-do list.
Wow. Well, how long have you been working with music, writing music?
I used to mess around with music as a kid. My mom had bought me this keyboard that I used to tinker around with, but I had stopped playing around with it. I wasn't too too serious. And then once I got into college, I had purchased another keyboard that I started playing with, and kind of just been playing since then. And yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, music and sport, they're two of the most just amazing pieces of communication, and it connects us all. It doesn't really matter where we come from, our backgrounds, our race, our whatever. You can get people on the field of play, and they can, you know, come together, they can connect. You throw some music on, it's the same way you're able to communicate to people in ways that you wouldn't be able to otherwise in a conversation. So to be able to tap into that talent, I think is really cool. And it just, you know, you can get so many different messages from music. It can be creative. And I think for me, at the end of the day, to be able to get off of the track and to decompress and to get away from the challenges and the stresses of sport, to tap into the music is another way to recover.
To take us back to that ledge in Raleigh, that place where you felt so much freedom, were reticent for a while to leap from after you lost your sight, then decided it was time that you do it. And you said at first to recapture, and then you said it felt entirely different to jump off that ledge after you had lost your sight. Have you reflected on how your life has changed and where you might be if none of that had happened?
That's a good question. I think that it's hard for me to venture into that world of what would have happened had I not jumped off of the ledge, because I just can't imagine anything other. That action has that's consumed my mind. That has helped me to trampoline into this world of opportunities. And again, when you think about gravity, that is people's expectations, or from my perspective as a person with a disability, you think about how society is set up and how it's organized, and in a lot of ways it's not the most conducive for someone who is blind. You think about all of those things and how that ledge helped me to soar above that. And to think about the connections and relationships that I've been able to build, people who have helped to challenge my thinking, to help to shift my thinking to this point where, I'm experiencing great things from an athletic standpoint, but still being able to go in and advocate not only for myself, but others who live a similar experience to me, so that we can change how society views us.
Lex Gillette, Raleigh's own world record holder in the long jump for totally blind athletes. Lex, thank you so much.
Thank you, Frank.
Thank you for listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill.